Zabluski versus Astru.
May it please the Court. I'm Heather Freeman on behalf of Appellant Alan Zabluski. The ALJ's decision should be reversed due to the error in rejecting the opinions of Dr. Cooley and Nurse Kennedy, the two treating sources, rendering an unsupported functional capacity finding, finding Zabluski not credible, and failing to comply with SSR 004P. First, the ALJ erroneously rejected the opinions of Dr. Cooley and Nurse Kennedy and also failed to explain how he arrived at the residual functional capacity, or RFC, finding. The ALJ failed to build a logical bridge between the evidence and his conclusion. The ALJ's reasons for rejecting Dr. Cooley's opinion are not supported by the evidence of record and failed to comply with the Regulation 20 CFR, Section 404.1527. The vocational testimony demonstrates that Zabluski would be deemed disabled even if only portions of Dr. Cooley's opinion were credited. Similarly, Zabluski would be deemed disabled if Nurse Kennedy's opinion had not been rejected contrary to SSR 063P. The opinions of both treatment sources are fully supported by the evidence of record, diagnostic testing, and the opinions of other specialists. Furthermore, the ALJ did not mention the opinion of the non-examining physicians. As a result, the district court's and the commissioner's reliance on these opinions was impermissible post hoc rationale. Even if the state agency opinions are considered, they fail to support the ALJ's findings. The first state agency opinion from Dr. Baumblatt from September of 2004 was not based on the complete record and contained only a statement of CEWS as the rationale. It is significantly different also from the ALJ's finding. The second state agency opinion from Dr. Callier in January of 2005 is even more problematic in that it purports to rely on Dr. Cooley's opinion, but is actually in direct conflict with her opinion. The ALJ's findings are not linked to any opinions of record and, more importantly, are unexplained. Second, the ALJ's credibility determination was erroneous. The ALJ discredited Zabluski due to, quote, significant lapses, unquote, that were actually irrelevant inconsistencies, such as his confusion as to the name for his hepatitis-induced arthritis. At the same time, the ALJ failed to comply with SSR 96-7P in considering the medical documentation of Zabluski's unusually extreme effects of hepatitis and the side effects of treatment. The consulting rheumatologist, Dr. Malone, confirmed that Zabluski's arthralgias were directly related to his ongoing hepatitis, and his other complaints were linked to the underlying problems by other underlying problems by examining orthopedists, otolaryngologists, and sleep medicine physicians. The ALJ erred in failing to properly consider Zabluski's unusually severe symptom complex and the side effects. Third, the ALJ failed to comply with SSR 004P. The commissioner concedes that the ALJ failed to ask the VE whether the testimony was consistent with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. This failure is contrary to SSR 004P. However, the commissioner argues that the testimony was given, quote, within the context of the DOT, unquote, because the DOT was referenced when the VE classified Zabluski's past work. However, the decision was not made on the basis of Zabluski's past work. There was no reference to the DOT when discussing additional work that he could perform, and even the commissioner admits that the exchange was not completely clear. The ALJ did not comply with SSR 004P. The VE's testimony that the jobs can be performed with a sit-stand option creates an apparent conflict with the DOT. And the DOT does not address sit-stand options. Finally, contrary to the commissioner's assertion, and according to this court's holding in Prochaska, the representative at the hearing did not have the burden of challenging the VE testimony. Because the ALJ did not first comply with SSR 004P, which was his affirmative duty, there was no Donahue or challenge burden that was placed on the representative. Therefore, we respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the administrative law judge. Thank you.
Ms. Siegel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Siegel. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this case. In this case, the ALJ had a perfectly reasonable basis for questioning the credibility of the claimant's disability claim. At his hearing, the claimant talked about what his disabling impairments were, and he talked at length about the right knee impairment and the back impairment resulting in restrictions that limited him to less than ability to do sedentary work. And initially he talked about how he had injured himself at work, but then that it got worse because of rheumatoid arthritis. And the ALJ noted this in his decision and then looked at the record to see what the evidence of the rheumatoid arthritis was. And in fact, there is no evidence of rheumatoid arthritis. He was evaluated for that condition, but a rheumatologist found that he actually did not have that condition. It was ruled out. With regard to another impairment that the claimant talked about, it was a cardiac impairment. He said that it caused fatigue and it caused him to have balance problems, and he said that he had a heart attack in June 2006, and that's when all these symptoms started. But again, when the ALJ looked at the record, looked at the cardiology reports, looked at a hospitalization for 2 days where he did a full battery of tests for cardiac problems, the heart attack was completely ruled out. Cardiac enzymes did not show that he had a myocardial infarction. And there, again, the claimant's representations of his impairments was not accurate. There's another impairment that he also claims was disabling, and that's hepatitis C. And again, the portrayal of that diagnosis is overstated. The claimant had hepatitis C for a very short period of time. It appears to be first diagnosed in June of 2004 by a nurse practitioner who talks about hepatitis C symptoms being possible and that they would have to do a liver biopsy in 6 months after he no longer was drinking alcohol. And that biopsy then actually turned out to be normal. There were opinions later on that talked about the hepatitis C as being in remission. The claimant's own doctor says in July of 2005 that it's still in remission, and Dr. Collier, who reviewed the record, said that it was in remission because there were normal test findings in November 2004 and December 2004. So again, we have an impairment, but there's very little showing that it lasted for very long and very little showing that it actually limited the claimant. Now, the claimant here for the first time claims that the arthritis is due to hepatitis C. That was not something that the claimant had talked about at all in his testimony to the ALJ, and it's certainly not something that the doctors even brought up. Dr. Cooley actually talks about back pain and abdominal pain, but not that it was caused by hepatitis C. And in fact, she finds that it's not an active impairment after at least at the very latest July 2005 and possibly early, probably January 2005 is when Dr. Collier has findings that show that it's not active. So the ALJ's explanation of this evidence shows that the claimant was not credible, and he was very reasonable in assessing limitations of sedentary and light work with a sit-stand option and some occasional postural limitations. Now, although the claimant criticizes the ALJ for not tying his functional capacity assessment to a specific medical opinion, this court has never required a specific medical opinion to be tied to the functional capacity restrictions. He can consider any number of factors in determining what the limitations are. And here, the ALJ actually gave some credit to what the claimant said at the hearing. He actually did give some credit to the right knee pain and the back pain in assessing the sedentary and light restrictions and in assessing the postural limitations. And he said that in his decision, that although I don't find a whole lot of negative findings for or positive findings for the claimant, I don't find that the rheumatoid arthritis is present, and I find very minimal findings with regard to the back impairment, I'm still going to give him the benefit of the doubt and assess some limitations on the basis of back pain and knee pain. So that's a perfectly reasonable basis to find limitations, and given that we have a doctor who assessed light limitations due to a right knee impairment, and we have two doctors who said sedentary restrictions, that makes perfect sense. And the fact that he didn't specifically point to those opinions does not require a remand, because it's clearly evident in the record. With regard to the two doctors the doctor Cooley's opinion from November of 2004 that the claimant had more restrictions beyond sedentary work, I would like to point out that that opinion was given in November of 2004, which is probably the point where the hepatitis C was at its most active stage, and it was just beginning to be treated with interferon, and they were just beginning to have the medication side effects that were occurring because of that treatment. And so that it's not surprising that Dr. Cooley assessed very restrictive limitations at that point. But then later on, we see the record shows that his condition improved very dramatically, and to the point where that same doctor said that it was in remission. And later on, when the doctor talks about possible symptoms that might be tied to the hepatitis C, again in July and August of 2006, the most that she comes up with is sweating, and that is not even a definitive symptom tied to hepatitis C. She surmises it might be caused by it, but she doesn't suggest that the hepatitis C has recurred, and she doesn't point to any specific liver function tests that show a problem with hepatitis C recurring. So the ALJ reasonably rejected those very extreme limitations because they're not supported by the record as a whole. And similarly, the nurse Kennedy also did a hepatitis C questionnaire with lots of limitations. And for the same reason, her opinion also was validly rejected by the ALJ, because clearly the record shows that condition resolved after those opinions and would no longer cause those kind of limitations. With regard to the vocational expert testimony, the claimant relies on Prochaska to say that this sit-stand option should have been addressed in the in a DOT discrepancy issue, that there was a problem with the ALJ not asking specifically whether there were any DOT discrepancies. We have a different situation than Prochaska, because here we do have a VE who's talking about the DOT in his past relevant work testimony. It's rather similar to the Coleman case, in which we had a similar situation where the ALJ talked about the past relevant work findings in terms of the DOT numbers and restrictions, and then had a statement saying that if you had any discrepancies, you would have pointed those out to me. Is that right? And the vocational expert answers affirmatively. And that's at 410 and 411 of the transcript, where they had this exchange about the DOT and making sure that everything is in the same, that there aren't any discrepancies between the two. Then later on, when he talks about the jobs that are available, the vocational expert talks about where he got the sit-stand option from, and he talks about the basis being tied to his experience in the field. And so even if we did have a situation where they thought that this was actually a discrepancy, and our position is that it's not an actual discrepancy, because the DOT is actually silent on this issue, completely silent. They don't discuss sit-stand options for any jobs. But even if it did go back to talk about why there was a discrepancy, the vocational experts already testified here that he based this restriction on his experience in the field, that he has talked to people who have these jobs, and they've all said that they allow a sit-stand option. So there really wouldn't be any purpose to going back in that particular case. In this particular case, if you have any questions, no. Then I would just ask that the court affirm the commissioner's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Segal.
Did you announce your name as Friedman?
Yes, Your Honor. Apparently the
Did you sign in that way?
It's under Aloe. Apparently the name change got...
I didn't mean to not call you by the name you
wanted. No, that's fine. Sorry. The name change got lost in the shuffle somewhere, so...
We'll address you as you would like. That's all.
Right. It's undisputed that the claimant has hepatitis C. The claimant's statements at the hearing must be put in context that he has a 10th grade education, he's sick, he's going through all these different types of testing, he's got chest pain, he doesn't know why. His doctor says he's got the hepatitis-induced arthralgias, which are a fibromyalgia-type complex, but not fibromyalgia. I think it's natural for an individual in the situation to be a little bit confused. Besides, the relevant part of his testimony is it's not his testimony about what he thinks is medically wrong with him. It's his testimony about how it affects him. I think it's pretty clear in the records what his diagnoses are and how they affect him. And that's what the judge should have been looking at the medical evidence for, not at the claimant's testimony for. I think it's a bit much to expect an individual with a 10th grade education to recite precisely what exactly they do have and do not have in correct medical terms. It's also undisputed that his fibromyalgia type arthritis issue is linked to his underlying hepatitis C, which was not just present for a short period of time. It was active for at least a year prior to the treatment. And for disability claim to stand, all you need is something that's 12 months or more, and he clearly qualifies for that. And if you look at records at 238 to 40 and 340 to 41, it did have continuing symptoms even when in remission due to the underlying hepatitis C, per the treating physician. And it's not just sweating or diaphoresis. It's also fatigue, which is very important because the vocational expert testified that if his fatigue were credited, then he would not be able to sustain work. So here it's very important to look at the continuing problems, which were directly related to the hepatitis C and noted by multiple treating sources. In terms of the commissioner's argument that we're arguing that a specific medical opinion be tied to the RFC. Although that would have been nice, the case law does state that if you're not tying it to a specific medical opinion, you at least need to build a logical bridge from the facts to the conclusion, and the ALJ must explain where the RFC comes from if it's not coming from a physician opinion. Unfortunately, in this case, that did not happen. We have no linkage to a physician opinion, examining or non-examining, and no explanation as to the basis for that opinion. So that is the critical problem in this case. And they keep referring to the state agency physician reviews, which were incomplete and not referenced by the ALJ. So that's post hoc rationale. In terms of the date of Dr. Cooley's opinion, as I noted with reference to the record, even though the hepatitis was in remission, it was still present, underlying, causing problems, and the medical records illustrate that. And in terms of the VE, there was a clear violation of 004P. There is a discrepancy. This merits remand. The testimony in the context of the past relevant work is very specific to that in terms of how the client, how Zabluski actually performed his work and cannot be sort of integrated to overcome the clear violation of 004P. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Friedman. Thank you, Ms. Siegel. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.